This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. As every working mother knows, it's a juggling act. WBTV's Molly Grantham is one of those moms. She loves her kids, but she also loves her career. And she's been writing about the challenge of balancing both in a blog that has now become a book. And she joins us later in the program to talk about her real feelings. First, a potential solution to a problem that has been troubling some South Carolina electric ratepayers. Last year, a years-long construction project to build two new reactors at the Scannon nuclear plant was abandoned. Cost overruns plagued the project, as did construction delays. And finally, the lead contractor went into bankruptcy. All of this led to a debate on who would pay the costs for this unfinished project. Well, customers have been paying. But now, Virginia utility Dominion Energy has said it wants to buy Scannon and its debt. This could spell relief and result in a positive outcome for consumers, but it does face some regulatory hurdles, and there are other questions swirling around this. WFAE's David Borax, our environmental reporter, has been covering this story. He joins us now along with Avery Wilkes, the Statehouse reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia, and welcome to you both. Good morning, David.
Hello, Mike.
Morning, Avery.
Hi.
Hi. Speak up. It's radio. If we don't hear you, you're not on. Dominion Energy, which operates in several states, including this one, has announced that it intends to buy Scannon in South Carolina for about $7.9 billion in stock. But Scannon is not a healthy company for all the reasons I just mentioned. And Dominion Resources, or Dominion Energy, as they now call themselves, intends to assume Scannon's debt, which makes the deal worth $14.6 billion. Given all that, why would Dominion want to get involved at all with Scannon? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of. David, take it.
Well, let me dive in here from the business standpoint. You know, I think this deal might have happened someday even without the troubles that Scannon has been in, because Dominion is pretty strong in the mid-Atlantic area there, Virginia, part of North Carolina, West Virginia. South Carolina is an attractive addition to their network if you look at it that way. So I think there's a business reason for doing it. They told the Wall Street analysts, when they announced the deal, that this was going to add to their profits in the first year, which is always a good thing with a merger. So I think there's business reasons for doing it. One other thing to point out is Dominion is the developer of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which we've talked about on this program before, and that goes from West Virginia through Virginia into North Carolina, and it stubs out right at the South Carolina border.
So they'd like to continue that into the South Carolina area?
They hinted at that during the conference call with analysts this past week. So I think that's another argument. The company that they're buying, Scannon, has got great gas network in South Carolina, so it would be pretty easy to connect the two of those.
So Scannon is a wholly owned subsidiary, Avery, of SCE&G.
Vice versa.
So what's the difference? Does Scannon own other electric companies scattered around the area?
They own a few other, not necessarily electric companies. They own a natural gas company in North Carolina and a couple of other smaller subsidiaries. But SCE&G is certainly their largest. Their largest asset.
So SCE&G would disappear and become Dominion Energy under this arrangement?
It would. My understanding is that customers, you know, on their power bills would still say SCE&G. It would be a subsidiary of Scannon, which is a subsidiary of Dominion. And then possibly eventually those bills would start to say Dominion instead of SCE&G, but that change would not happen immediately.
And Scannon stands for what?
It actually doesn't stand for anything. It's just a collection of letters that are drawn from the letters in the state of South Carolina.
I think back in the 1990s, there was that trend of companies adopting letter names that didn't really stand for anything. Sometimes they had a historical meaning, but Scannon adopted that when they adopted the, we call it a holding company, the parent company, over SCE&G. And so SCE&G is about 80% of their earnings, and the rest of it comes from gas assets.
So here's how Dominion Energy CEO Thomas Farrell explained this proposed merger to analysts.
Scannon is a natural fit for Dominion Energy. Its utility operations are a complement to our existing electric operations in North Carolina and our natural gas pipeline business in South Carolina. This combination can open new expansion opportunities, including the Atlantic Coast Pipeline that is now under development, bringing lower cost natural gas to the region. The combination with Scannon would solidify Dominion Energy's position among the nation's largest and fastest growing energy infrastructure companies.
They also intend to refund SCANA's SCE&G customers some money that they've been paying in rates to pay for those plants. There's a little twist to this, which we'll talk about later, but why would they want to refund money, Avery?
I think it's, for PR purposes, it would be obviously a big boon to them. The customers can immediately, you're dangling out, we're going to give you $1,000 on average to help refund you for this. And it just includes the word refund itself. That's what a lot of people have wanted all along. I think initially a lot of customers saw that and were like, wow, this is great. Finally, somebody gets our concerns. Finally, somebody is willing to give us our money back for what we've spent in the project. Since then, in the days after the deal, there's been a lot more skepticism. People are starting to realize, both in the South Carolina General Assembly and regular folks around Columbia and Charleston in SCE&G service territory, that sure, you're getting refunded $1,000, but that is not that does not cover what you've been charged over the past decade or so for this project, nor does it mean an end to the nuclear charges that you've been paying all along. You're still going to be on the hook for this failed project for the next 20 years. So folks are sort of becoming more and more skeptical of this deal every day, and now it's just a big lobbying effort, and both sides are kind of spinning their tails of whether this is a really good deal or whether this deal should be looked at with increasing skepticism.
And again, here's the Dominion Resources CEO Thomas Farrell on how he explained this idea of refunds to his analysts.
We believe this is the largest utility customer refund ever made. Additional customer benefits meaningfully reduce the impact of nuclear development costs on South Carolina families and businesses.
So families might be initially excited about this, David, but what about stockholders? How do they feel about it?
Well, this company is in a bind right now. I think ever since the announcement last summer that they were canceling the VC Summer plant expansion in South Carolina, they've been trying to figure out their way out of this, and it's a really tangled web. I mean, it involves the state legislature. It involves the Utilities Commission down there, which has to approve any of this. And, if they can get some of their money back, that would be great. One point to make here is that after the announcement in July, the shares of SCANA fell 40%.
Yeah.
And so if you're a stockholder, you're in a hole right now.
So not only is the refund a little part of this tangled web of inscrutable stuff, which we'll talk about further. In addition, Dominion says it plans to reduce power rates going forward by about 5%. Are they doing that to make this deal more attractive to regulators in South Carolina, more attractive to stockholders of SCANA or customers of SCANA, to reflect the cost efficiencies that they, as a bigger company, perhaps could bring to the table? Why would they want to do this?
It's all part of this big package that they brought to the table. And maybe, Avery, you can talk some more about this. But, they've brought this deal to the table. They are already SCE&G and SCANA were already in discussions with lawmakers and the Utilities Commission about how to get out of this. This package looks similar to what they were offering. Maybe it's trying to be as definitive as it can to make the deal go through. But Avery, what are your thoughts on that?
That's exactly what I'd say. There are plenty of olive branches to seemingly all stakeholders in this deal. This deal would kind of sweeten SCE&G's previous proposal to cut their rates by about 3.5%. That would have dropped bills by $5 a month. Currently, SCE&G customers are paying on average about $27 a month for a nuclear project that will not be built. And people are really up in arms about that. SCE&G had proposed to cut that by about $5 per month and to continue gradually cutting that nuclear surcharge over the next 50 years. What this deal from Dominion would do is immediately cut it by about $7 per month for the next 8 years, and then it would gradually continue to reduce that amount to zero over the next 12.
So let's be clear. For 20 years, SCE&G ratepayers have been paying on average $27 a month just for this plant to be built?
They've been paying that for about 10 years so far,
wow.
And it hasn't been $27 the entire time. It's gradually worked up to that. But under this Dominion proposal, they would continue to pay some level, some amount of money for the nuclear project for the next two decades.
So that's the issue that's going to be debated here before this deal is approved, if it's approved, is whether the ratepayers should have to pay anything for this plant.
Yeah. The total cost of this failed project so far has been $9 billion, which, as we have mentioned, was shared by ratepayers, but it's also shared with a state-owned utility company called Santee Cooper, and they and their customers are into this to the tune of $4 billion. Dominion Energy is only offering to buy SCANA, and according to South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster, the only way to resolve the problem for Santee Cooper's customers is to sell that utility. Are there buyers for Santee Cooper?
There are a number of companies who are interested in buying Santee Cooper or taking it over in some way. There are a ton of different ideas being flown around about, you know, whether you buy the whole thing, whether you buy certain assets of it, whether you go into joint dispatched agreements with SCANA or with Santee Cooper. There are four major companies that were that are involved in those talks, to my knowledge. Those are Duke Energy, Southern Company, Dominion, which obviously is looking at buying SCANA too, and NextEra Energy out of Florida. It's unclear how the purchase of SCANA may affect Dominion's interest in buying Santee Cooper as well. But those are the four companies that that have signed non-disclosure agreements and have entered a significant level of negotiation with the governor's office.
Well, this has to go through state regulators, and since the governor's chimed in on this, why wouldn't they have put together a deal that combines the purchase of both of those utilities at the same time?
Two separate companies, two separate deals.
So. Okay. So they're offering these refunds to ratepayers. They're talking about reducing electric rates going forward, and they're talking about having these ratepayers continue to pay for a project that will never open for the next 10 or 20 years or so. Why not forego the refunds, reduce the rates even more, and hasten the demise of this ongoing payment for a project that will never open?
Yeah, you're raising an issue which came up during this conference call with analysts, which is that Dominion doesn't want to have too much happen to the terms of this deal that would change the economics of it. They do have provisions in their agreement with SCANA that say if the legislature or the utility regulators do anything to muck up the terms that they have, that they could walk away from this
deal. Well, here's a better question. If you're going to lower rates by 5% and you're going to continue to have people pay extra on their bills for the next 20 years to pay for this plant, why not forego the reduction in rates and pay it off sooner?
You mean all at once?
Well, not all at once, but if you're giving people 5% reductions, keep that 5% and pay off the demise costs earlier.
I think the simple answer is that they'd rather pay it off over time with money that's coming into the company rather than take a big chunk out of it. So
how did we get here in the first place? That's a good question to open up to in a moment or two, and also what this means for the nuclear industry, because nuclear was poised to make a comeback in the last 10 years. And then suddenly there was the Fukushima incident in Japan, and then this incident now. And I learned just yesterday that electric utilities around the world are planning to phase out nuclear power plants now, in the next between 2025 and now. They plan to do this. So just 20 years ago, they were all set to build more. What happened? What changed? We'll talk about that in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Wildology, helping people provide food, water, and shelter to the birds through the cold weather, providing bird seed, bird bath heaters, and roosting boxes located in Waverly at Providence at 485. Go Wildology.com. And Fresh Dental, with a full suite of general, cosmetic, and restorative services for the entire family. Emergency cases and walk-ins accepted at all four Charlotte area locations. Details at FreshDentalCLT.com. The midterms are coming. They're about 11 months away, but they're almost here. And Democrats are hopeful that after a deep state win in Alabama and the president's ongoing troubles, they have a shot at capturing either the House or the Senate or both. Meanwhile, Republicans hope to reap the benefits of their tax victory, among other things. We'll talk about all this with a political scientist and two consultants, two strategists, both a Democrat and a Republican, tomorrow at 9.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, the Trump administration rules nearly 200,000 Salvadorans must leave the country or be deported. Now what? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here, our environmental reporter from WFAE News, and Avery Wilk, State House reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia. And we're talking about the potential purchase of SCANA and SCE&G by Dominion Energy out of Virginia, but they also operate in Ohio and West Virginia and North Carolina and elsewhere. Let's go back a second. It takes a while to plan and design and build a nuclear power plant. SCANA was building two. Why did they want to build those plants? What was the need that they saw, Avery?
They, SCANA estimated, you know, with South Carolina's growing population, that it would have a pretty significant need for more energy in South Carolina. And it thought nuclear was the best way to go about that. The company already had one nuclear reactor that it owned jointly with Santee Cooper in Fairfield County at the V.C. Summer Nuclear Station. It owned 66% of that. Santee Cooper owned the other third of it. And they thought that was sort of the future. You know, with at the time, there were lots of concerns about carbon and carbon regulation. I don't think natural gas was as in vogue as it is now, and nuclear did seem to be the future in their eyes.
And this was when? What? Give me the year when they started planning and designing.
They got a law passed at the state legislature that enabled them to start this project in 2007. So around there before then is when they would have begun actually planning to build these two reactors.
So a lot must have changed between then and now, because one of the factors leading to stop this project, along with the bankruptcy and stuff that we'll talk about, was the decreasing demand for electricity because of increased efficiency. I mean, electric companies are pushing LED light bulbs and Energy Star certified appliances and things like that. And there are now other forms of energy production that were not efficient or not, they didn't make economic sense 20 years ago.
You know, decreasing demand is not why this plant got canceled. It got canceled for all those other reasons we're talking about, the problems.
Well, I understand that, but I just want to talk about how technology has changed so rapidly that even if they had been successful in building this, they didn't really need it.
They could have probably gotten away with just one of those, for example.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what they've done in the – so whenever you cancel a plant like this, everybody asks, well, are you going to be able to meet demand? And that was a question that was hanging this summer, but they pretty quickly turned around and announced that they're buying this gas-fired power plant that will also – that sale will continue even after Dominion acquires SCANA. So they will have the capacity. But, you know, I think the point here is that maybe they didn't need all of the capacity that they were doing, but they will still need some in the future.
Is that because they didn't do due diligence or because technology has simply outpaced what they thought it could do?
I think it would be fair to say that things have changed enough that the picture changed, as you're pointing out.
And as you mentioned, they didn't stop this because all of a sudden LED light bulbs are available. They stopped this because there were project delays, there were cost overruns, and the bankruptcy of their key contractor, Westinghouse Electric, just kind of put the final nail in the coffin. And then Santee Cooper, the other utility, pulled out of this project. So was all of this beyond the control of SCANA? Are they as much of a victim, Avery, in all of this as the ratepayers are?
They would certainly like you to believe that. If you listened only to SCANA, you would come out of it believing that that Westinghouse had hoodwinked them, had pulled the wool over their eyes, had hid things from them over the course of the project, had given them false reports of progress at the nuclear site, and just generally made a ton of promises that Westinghouse could not and ultimately did not deliver. However, you know, lawmakers have spent months investigating this. There have been reports that have come out, most particularly the long secret Bechtel report that was done and published in secretly in February 2016 that showed that SE&G and Santee Cooper and the owners did bear some level of blame for not necessarily overseeing the project as well as it could have, and not being as tough on the contractors as they could have been throughout. Obviously, that's a matter of opinion, but I would say SE&G and SCANA and lawmakers and the public definitely see that question differently.
Right now, Duke Energy's six nuclear plants produce half of the electricity used by their customers in the Carolinas, and they are described as reliable, efficient, carbon-free, and relatively cheap, and running nonstop to what the company calls base generation. They're always on supplying a level of power dependably, cheaply, and in terms of energy production, cleanly. Other forms of energy supplement nuclear. Is the plan to change that paradigm in South Carolina now when Dominion comes in, if they come in, and resort to wind or solar or natural gas in greater abundance here? What is their plan?
Their plan is to keep doing things the way they do, I think. We didn't hear anything about we didn't hear very much about any kind of alternative energy resources being brought to bear here, but I think that that's the way it'll go.
Why were these costs to build these two nuclear plants, when it looked like they were going to be built, why were they being passed on to ratepayers? Why weren't they being passed on to shareholders? Is that the common way to do things around the country?
That is that's something that changed with this new wave of nuclear. SE&G and, well, I guess SCANA lobbied the State House to change basically the rule book. They changed the law about how exactly you go about building a large, expensive project like this in order to shift the risks really from the company to the company's customers. The Base Load Review Act passed in 2007 was hardly debated at all. It passed extremely quickly. Seems like lawmakers really gave SE&G the benefit of the doubt that this bill does what you say it does, and this bill is going to be good for everybody. But what it allowed SE&G to do was to charge customers for the plant while it was being built, and to get a determination from state regulators that the plant was used and was useful, even though it didn't exist at that point, which is kind of radical when you look at that now. A lot of other state legislatures did that, changed the rules like that across the country. Around that time, but that's the law that lawmakers are really looking at repealing now when they return to Columbia today, because everyone sees it now as a blank check for SE&G.
And just to jump in here, that 2007 law is really one of the things we have to put on the list of how did this happen. The fact that they were able to charge as they went, and basically the only thing that was required was that they had to come in every so often and say, yeah, we're still building it.
Yeah. So let's amplify that a little bit before we move on to something else here, because Dominion expects to close on this deal by the third quarter of this year, and they have a clause in their contract, their deal, that should regulators or lawmakers change anything about the economics of the deal, they can walk away. And this thing's on the table today, this 2007 law, which a key part of which allows SCE&G to continue charging its customers for this unbuilt project. Is it likely to be taken away? Is that permission, that law, likely to go away today or in the next week or so or month or so as lawmakers talk about, chew this over?
Ava? I wouldn't think it's going to happen in the next week or maybe even the next month. That is the number one issue, top of mind for lawmakers.
Yeah, because Tom Farrell, the CEO of Dominion, has said that the whole thing hinges on this law staying in place.
Exactly. It's a deal killer. And Farrell clarified that he is okay with certain aspects of the law changing for future use. For example, if you want to repeal it for future use so no other company comes in and tries to build a giant plant like this and charge customers, totally fine with that. But what Dominion absolutely needs for this deal, or what they say that they won't negotiate on, is leaving the ability to continue to charge customers in the future, even after the plant has been abandoned. They say that they they have to be able to keep charging for the next 20 years or this deal is off.
And I think, David, you alluded to this early in the conversation. This is part of the problem. But the other part of the problem is that even though initially ratepayers thought, well, gee, $1,000 in my pocket as a refund, that's a pretty good deal. That's finally someone is thinking about us. Well, now that they've had a chance to think this over, and as others have had a chance to think this over, evidently, consumer watchdogs are saying the refunds don't go far enough. If they throw that wrench into the works, does that change the economics of the deal? If lawmakers say, okay, we'll leave this 2007 law in place because you say that's a deal breaker, but we want $2,000 back for every customer, is that a deal breaker?
You know, there's probably some room here for the company to do some negotiating on what those numbers are. And I'm not so sure the 1,000 number is the key one. I think it's the 5% reduction in rates. I think what may be asked for is a higher number there. I think that works out to about $7 a customer. And as Avery mentioned, I think they're paying about $27 a customer right now. I think the question here is how close that can they get to getting back all of that $27 a month?
The pluses about nuclear energy that are touted by energy companies are that they are clean, they're carbon-free, they don't emit emissions, et cetera, et cetera. But there are people who just don't like the idea because if there's a disaster, it could be life-changing, a disaster at a nuclear power plant, although we've had several plants fail and that has not come to be. But between Fukushima and this project going belly up and the fact that electric utilities across the world, in Germany, in France, in Japan, and now here, are planning to phase out nuclear power plants by 2025, is this the end of nuclear energy? Is this it?
Absolutely not. They're still being built like crazy in Asia. So India and China are the leaders in nuclear construction right now. Interestingly, they're using some of the same technology that was going to be used at this plant. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question is whether they will continue, those companies that make this technology and build these plants will stay in business if there's enough business.
So the purchase offer needs to be approved by regulators in South Carolina, in North Carolina, and Georgia as well. Why all three states, Avery?
I understand it's because Dominion has assets in each of those states, if I'm not mistaken, and so does Canada.
And as the State House reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia, what's your feeling? What are you hearing around the halls? Are they likely to let this go ahead?
If I had a dime for every Wall Street analyst that's asked me that question over the past week, it's changing every day. I think that there's a sense just on principle from SC lawmakers and a lot of, you know, important leaders in the State House that we just can't allow a company to continue to charge our constituents for something they're not going to get. That's just a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously a deal breaker on Dominion side of things too. So obviously lawmakers' ability to change and repeal the Base Load Review Act gives them a seat at the table of these negotiations. So if I had to guess, at this point, I would assume that lawmakers are going to try to work their power to give themselves a seat and try to negotiate as much as they can the terms of that Dominion deal as it stands. Also, another key date that we haven't mentioned is that SE&G has said that if you slice off that nuclear surcharge, that $27 a month we're charging people, we'll go bankrupt. That's SE&G has mentioned that several times. Mm. That's something that obviously ratepayers and lawmakers don't want. But there is a state regulators have commissioned an audit that will come out January 19th that will show whether SC&G actually can absorb that rate cut and still remain viable. So if that comes out and it shows that SC&G could actually slice, you know, $27 off of its monthly power bills and still remain viable, then lawmakers don't have that much incentive to go forward with this Dominion deal.
Well, we'll have to stay tuned and watch this as it develops. Avery Wilkes is the State House reporter for the state newspaper. David Borax, our environmental reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you both. Appreciate it. Well, there is this thing called work-life balance. Every working person struggles with it, but perhaps working moms have the toughest time. It's never easy juggling the needs of your children with the demands of your job. And if you're in a highly visible, deadline-oriented profession like, oh, I don't know, anchoring TV news, the pressures are simply that much more. Molly Grantham has been anchoring WBTV News For years, it's a job that she loves. She also loves her two children. But if truth be told, and she does tell the truth, there are days when Molly would rather be at work than at home. Now, if you're a working mom, and that sounds familiar to you, you might want to pick up a copy of Molly's book, Small Victories, The Off-Camera Life of an On-Camera Mom. And if, as a working mom, reading is simply off the table because you don't have time, well, stick with us because Molly Grantham is here to share some of what she's written about in this book. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Mike.
So you work in this high-profile, and I know this to be a fact, high-profile, high-pressure job. You face deadlines every day. You can't, people don't think about this, you can't be late for work. You can't just leave at the drop of a hat because somebody gets sick. You work holidays. It's not 9 to 5. You work about 50-plus hours every single week doing what you do. Does that make what you face as a working mother harder than you think than it is for most women?
No, not at all. I mean, I think that I work nights 2 to midnight every day. So that's a unique schedule for anybody, like you do mornings and you have high deadlines and all those same things that you live with. But 2 to midnight is different for me than most people. But the job you have, I don't think matters. It's just trying to juggle all this stuff. And I almost don't think a lot of this book comes off like working mom versus stay-at-home mom. It's not what it is. In my head, it's more like not making your kids all that you are and finding something else for you and finding your outlet. Maybe some women love being at home with their children all the time, 24 hours a day. That's great. Most women I talk to, whether they're working or not, miss themselves when their kids are young. They want something else.
And men never think about this. This is never part of, I don't think. Maybe some men do.
I think some men do. I think early stages, probably. Okay. Not as much.
But this is something that women have had to struggle with because there was that adage back in the, I guess, 70s, you can have it all.
Right.
And as they tried to have it all, they felt guilty about trying to have it all. Did you ever feel guilty about trying to have it all?
That's a great question. I've never felt guilty about trying to have it all. I've always known I've wanted it all. I have. I mean, that's just the truth of it. But I've never felt guilty about that. What I have felt guilty about is some days, do I give enough to my kids? Or some days, am I shorting WBTV on things? So I never feel like I'm 50-50, ever. There's no balance.
But don't guys do that too? Don't your male colleagues short WBTV sometimes because of their personal lives?
I think so, but it oftentimes falls on the woman, especially when kids are young. Maternity leave. Men don't get maternity leave,
right,
not the way that a woman does.
Right.
And I had to take 3 months off of work. I mean, I couldn't be at work, and I had to be with kids all day long, and it made me a little nuts.
Yes, you're right about that. But this 2 to midnight schedule, that isn't a weird schedule.
It's an odd schedule.
So you get to spend the morning with your kids, and your kids are 6 and 3, is that right?
6 and 3. So, well, sometimes, because now she's in school, the 6-year-old's in school, so I take her to the bus stop this morning.
So do you, and that's the last you'll see of her today.
And then I go home for dinner for like a 48 to 50-minute dinner break.
I was going to ask if you got to go home for dinner, because that's it. I mean, do you feel that you never see the kids now?
No, we have set things up where I make sure I see them. They know they're loved. And people ask me that, like, do you feel like you're shorting the kids? If I ever felt like they thought they were getting shorted or they didn't feel loved, I would probably reassess the whole situation.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But
you've gotten to that stage. That's not something you probably would have said before.
No, well, I would have. But the thing is, they're great. You know, they are loved. And I am a better mom because I love my job and I have an outlet.
Right.
And if I was unhappy with that, then I would change it up.
Molly Grantham is our guest. She, of course, news anchors the 5:30 and 11 on WBTV and is the author of Small Victories, The Off-Camera Life of an On-Camera Mom. So much to talk about as we delve into this book, which we will do when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Henderson Properties, a full-service real estate company serving the Charlotte region for over 26 years. From managing rental properties to managing HOAs, Henderson is committed to its clients. HendersonProperties.com. And Mecklenburg Area Catholic Schools announcing open enrollment at all schools, including St. Gabriel, for the 2018-19 school year. Details at discovermacs.org. The Trump administration rules that nearly 200,000 Salvadorans must leave the country or be deported. And guest host Ray Suarez will be talking with his guests about this latest move and a previous move affecting Haitians. That's going On Point, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock here on WFAE. And Molly Grantham, WBTV news anchor and mom. More with her in a moment.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The sound of protests in Iran, which have reached a new level of intensity.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The protesters were a chatty crowd when they gathered at Romare Bearden Park. Their small talk was soon interrupted.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I'm talking to Molly Grantham, anchor at WBTV News, and a mom of a 6-year-old daughter and a 3-year-old son. Oh my! How these posts, this book started as posts on Facebook, partly because you were going stir crazy at home.
I was going out of my mind. Hutch, the son who's 3 now, was 6 days old, and Parker was 3 and a half, my daughter. And I was on maternity leave, and I was at home with these 2 kids. And when you have a baby, the first baby, it's like bouquets and all this celebration, and people stop by. And the second baby, there's nothing, like the fanfare is done. So I'm sitting there on day 6, husband had gone back to work, and just crazy, insane, crazy. That's all I had. And so I know a lot of other women maybe don't feel that way, but the honesty and my truth is that I just wanted something else. And so I just sort of wrote on paper, and then I put it on Facebook, small victory, showered today, small victory. And the response was surprising to me. I was embarrassed to put it out there, but I had to get it out of my head. And once I got it out there, an hour later, I went back and looked and was really surprised at the response from people everywhere.
Regular
not just
people.
Women.
Mm-hmm,
regular
yeah, not,
people.
And not just women. You point that out. Guys are responding too. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think sometimes guys are like, wow, my wife said this, or my mom always said this, or, you know, they never have the experience of giving birth and having 2 children where you're at home on maternity leave. And so it's a little bit of something that they haven't touched and they don't know. And to hear someone say in raw truth, it's not all, you know, angels and singing flowers, like, it was sort of interesting to hear their response, like, wow, that made me understand. As the blogs went on, I did one every week on maternity leave with Hutch because it started helping me feel sane.
But did your mom work?
She did. She had a couple different jobs. She never had like a career per se. She was a school nurse at one point. She did start her own catering business out of our home. She was a really like a mommy's mom kind of thing, but also tried to have other things on the side.
And you'd been writing this for how long before you decided to turn this into a book?
It was pretty random. It was early last year that I decided to turn it into a book.
So how long had you been writing?
So week 1, and then it turned into, like, when I went back to work, months. So month 4, month 5, month 6, and it went up to month 30. The book goes up to month 30.
What role did your mother, your late mother, play in you deciding to put this into a book?
She's why I did it last year. She's why I did it fast. She had lived with breast cancer for a while, and in April we got a timeline, and then it went really fast. And we had one conversation before she passed about, hey, mom, I think I'm going to write this book about being a mom. And then I was with her, and I write about it in the afterword of the book. But in the hospice house, I was with her sort of working on this, editing it. Yeah. And then once she passed, I thought, I have to go do this. Because if I don't do this now, and I don't do this year, I will feel like that conversation we had wasn't really right or true. And I want to play it out.
So if you'd written this book in the 1970s, you talked about this work-life balance and the fact that you chose to stay going back to work, that would probably be more groundbreaking or revolutionary. But today, there's so many working moms out there. This, it seems to me that this book is not revolutionary. It's more supportive. It's more, you're not the only person who has thought these thoughts. I've thought them too, and I'm brave enough to put them out there. Because some of these thoughts that you write about, some people might go, oh my God, how can you say that?
I think you're exactly right. I don't think it's revolutionary, but no one was saying it.
Right.
No one was saying it. And when I was feeling crazed,
which is helpful.
It was helpful. I wasn't saying it to be helpful to others. I was selfishly saying it to save myself and get the thoughts out of my head and cop to it.
Right.
And so when I started saying it and people responded, I thought, wow, there really isn't anyone else saying this. Or maybe if they're saying it, it's too hidden or something. There were people latching on to me being honest about it. It's not that I don't love my kids. Obviously, I love my kids. And if things were different, you know, I said if, you know, they weren't happy or they felt unloved, I would change things.
Yeah.
But I love who I am working as well.
But not only are you honest, you're a public person who is being honest. And that
was a little scary.
That's
too.
Pretty rare, because it's very scary. I mean, it could impact how people see you in what you do very publicly. The first sentence in your book reads, I like working sometimes more than I like being a mom. And you say there are days when you'd rather be at work than with the kids. And when you first discovered you were pregnant with your first child, you had what you describe as awfully mixed feelings. That's a quote. How did those feelings make you feel?
Well,
how did you feel about the feelings?
I mean, they were my feelings, so I can own my own feelings. You know, I'm fine with if I feel good or bad or mixed or whatever. I'm not going to feel guilty about my own feelings. What I was struggling with is that everybody was so excited and that everybody wanted me to be talking about being pregnant and being a news anchor who's growing as big as a house on set, and everybody can talk about my maternity clothes and what is a workout you do, you know, when you're pregnant. And, like, none of that mattered to me.
You didn't talk about it.
I didn't talk about it. And I mean, after Parker was born, I didn't talk about it.
Right. Does that strike you now as odd, or were you fighting the idea of being a mom?
I think I struggled. It took me a while to wave the white flag to motherhood.
Because people may not know this, but you write about this in the book. You anchored the 5:30 news on the day you gave birth.
Oh, I was in labor.
You were in labor. You were having contractions on the air.
In my defense, I'd worked a long time on a story that was airing that night at 11 o'clock. Really long time. And I wanted to front it. And she was a week early, and I thought I'd have time to do it. And I didn't. And so I look at that now and laugh about it in the book, and I understand that sounds preposterous to most people. But when you're so embedded in your career and you are passionate about what you're doing, and in particular, the story was about an elderly woman who wanted to get off probation. She'd served time for murder after her husband was abusive, and she thought he was going to kill her and the kids first. I wanted to tell that story.
But your co-anchor, Jamie Bull, I think in a break, leaned over and said, "I don't want to be your Lamaze coach. You need to go." Oh. I mean, what would have happened? I mean,
well, I obviously would not have had the baby on TV.
How do you know?
I would not have. I don't think anyone there. They would have come out after me and said, "Molly, we don't care what you say, leave."
We'll be back, not with her, after this break. another example of your brave, I think it's brave honesty, is putting these unorthodox feelings in a book, not just online where few people can see it. Lots of people can see it everywhere, I suppose. But you say that hours after your daughter was born, you were alone with her. Your husband was sacked out on the little chair that they have in every hospital room asleep. And you were staring at your daughter, quote, "anticipating unconditional love to burst open my soul with a sensation I'd never experienced, only it wasn't coming." And you admit asking yourself, "What's wrong with me?" You put that in writing. What have you heard about that?
I've had other women say they felt the same thing.
Really?
And in that particular passage you pulled out, I've had other women say they felt the same thing. Commercials tell you, songs tell you, movies tell
you. Sure.
The world tells you, society tells you that you have a baby and you are suddenly just washed over with emotion. And I was like, okay, well, she's beautiful. She's cute. She's cool. She has like this little scrunchy nose, little yellow skin. And now I'm a mom. Okay. Like that happened today. That was sort of my instinct. And obviously, I don't mean that to sound harsh or unkind or unloving, but that was my feeling in that moment. Days to come, it changed. Weeks to come, it changed. Life to come, it certainly changed.
Yeah.
But in that instant, I didn't feel it instantly.
But now you've put it in writing,
right.
And it's in a book that will be around for a long time. What do you suppose your daughter's reaction might be when she's old enough to read that?
It's my truth. And I want her to always be honest with her own truths and her own feelings. And she knows, again, she's loved. She is an amazing little girl, and I feel like I'm a really good mom, and she loves me. So if she realizes that took a couple days to understand what it was like to have a baby, that's okay. Maybe she'll be the same way. Maybe she'll be different.
People on television get a bad rap. People on
you
TV.
Think?
Yeah. they get a bad rap. They think people watch and they think, well, all she's doing is reading the teleprompter. And that's one tenth of the job. And it is deadline oriented and fact checking oriented. And there are so many things that you have to juggle, because not only are you anchoring newscasts, you're reporting on stories, and you've chosen to do some stories that are fairly in-depth and require great precision. It's not just chasing blue lights down the street. So that's a lot on your shoulders. What is it about that job that made you want to go back to that pressure cooker as opposed to stay at home?
Well, that's what makes me. I mean, why is it that any of us in this broadcast industry, whether radio or television or newspaper, whatever it is, why is it that we're doing what we're doing? I like the fast pace. I like being able to do a lot of different things. I like that every day is different.
Yeah.
Not all days are good, but I like that every day is different.
You write about needing work, enjoying work, feeling eager to get back to work after the birth of your first child, and you had the advantage of immediate feedback when you started writing about this on Facebook because people can comment.
The advantage or disadvantage?
Yeah, well, most of it was supportive, wasn't
it?
It
really was. I didn't know that when I first put it out.
What were the meanies saying? Because there are meanies out there. People think they can say anything to you on Facebook or Twitter.
The trolls, the negatives. You should be a mother. Your children are your most important thing. How could you say that you want to be at work? Yeah. How could you say that you miss yourself? You're staring at the most beautiful thing in the world. That's the best gift. Sure, absolutely. But I think people are, not just one-sided, and you can have other interests besides just what's in front of your face.
When your son arrived a few years after your daughter, 3 years after your daughter, that's when you admitted your normal, as you say, was really gone. You were now officially in momdom. That was several years ago. How have things changed? How have you changed in that time period?
Well, as he gets older, I don't know, Mike. I'm going to have to really think about that one. How have I changed since having two versus one, or how have I changed since he's gotten older?
Well, since you've acknowledged that this is now your normal, the old single or married with no children, Molly Grantham, is now officially not coming back.
Right. She's not officially coming back, and I'm okay with that. I love Parker and Hutch, and I'd never replace them. Having two made me have to just cop to the fact I had kids and I was a mother and I wasn't just some bulldog journalist. Yeah. I was someone else and I had all these multifacets. And, when you have two kids, it's just easier when you have one. It just is. I don't know if it's different when you have three or four. Some people say the second you have multiple, like two, three, four, five, it's all sort of surrender. I don't know, but
yeah, I was going to find that. I have a comment about yes. Here it is. A reader, Lynn B, one of your readers on Facebook, sent this comment to you, and I love this comment. The difference between one child and two is the difference between one and 12. A third just means surrender, Dorothy. They win. Go with it. That's a great comment.
Well, and in that, it is a great comment. A lot of the Facebook feedback to me was helpful. I was getting the thoughts out of my head to save my own sanity,
right.
But the people that responded, and all ages, some women that were going through it with kids the exact same ages as mine, some that were remembering 60 years ago when they had kids, it was all ages and many men. It was helpful to me. It was like being able to talk with a huge focus group that you're not crazy or that these thoughts aren't completely abnormal. No one else is saying them. Thank you for saying them. But I had those same thoughts. I just never said them before. You're not nuts.
I wanted to ask about that because you said that you wrote this down, first of all, on paper to get the thoughts out of your head. Because let's face it, you're a writer. I mean, you write extremely well. And that's what you
Thank
do
you.
For a living.
Thank
and the
you.
Book is really well written.
Thank you.
But that's what writers do. They get it out of there. That's how people find out who they are if they're writers. They write it down.
I agree with that.
But you didn't have to put it on Facebook.
I didn't.
So once you got it out, what was your impetus to put it on Facebook? Was that just a natural progression for somebody who does what you do? You're a reporter.
It might have been. But remember, with Parker, I didn't even talk about her. So when it came to Hutch 3.5 years later and I had these thoughts and I put it on paper, it was almost like, Facebook had obviously grown. Social media in our industry had obviously grown. And there was this moving world outside. And I could check everything else that was moving, but I felt stagnant. Mm. And so it was more like a sensation of contributing to it, even though it was nothing that I'd ever contributed before. Nothing. I was never saying, like, small victory, I showered today. Nothing. That was not even my way of being personal on Facebook. I was all about headlines and news and fun and excitement, but, like, never my own life or Parker or personal. And then it was just, like, I was there. It was day six. These two babies, they're both screaming. And I'm looking at all this other stuff and headlines and Facebook feeds and Twitter was big and all these things. And I just sort of jumped into it because that was my truth in that moment.
Talk about writing for a second. Because historians have bemoaned the fact that we don't write as a culture anymore. They could go back in time and they can get the letters of people who lived in the 1700s and the 1800s, even the 1900s. And we learn from those letters about what their lives were like and what they were going through, what they were struggling with. Today, you put it out on Twitter, which who knows if you'll be able to archive that material and get it back in 50 years or not.
Or if
you put it out
to.
On, yeah, or if you want to. But you like the idea, if I'm not mistaken, of writing it down, putting it on paper, keeping a diary, also feeding Facebook with it, but doing all these things. Why Why is that important to you?
It's just always been important to me. I still like a handwritten letter. I still check the mailbox. I like writing them.
When's the last time you got one?
Christmas cards, okay. But, I still do that. My New Year's resolution 2 years ago was to write more handwritten letters. I mean, I still keep that very top of mind. I try to teach Parker at this age to still do that. My dad raised me to be that way. I've always loved the written word, and I've always loved writing things down.
And I believe that you advocate other women and men, too, and just write about your daily life.
Right. You never need to show anyone. You certainly don't need to put it on Facebook. I did, but you don't have to. But document what you're doing. Document what you're doing. This is a digital scrapbook of some sorts that I made into a real book
right.
So my kids can read it, because you don't know what will happen with Facebook someday. But I have always kept these not just on Facebook. Once I write them, I put them into a Word document. So no matter what happens to Facebook, I have them. And it ended on
maybe.
maybe Word document. We'll see.
You better print it out.
Right. I think you're correct on that. But it did go to month 30, which was last April, and I continue to write them. You know, I've had month 31, 32, 33, and I just last week posted month 38.
In your chapter called Week 4, you write about having a 3.5-year-old and a newborn and how hectic that makes life. And you say, you know there will be a time when you will miss this. There is a saying that when people reach the end of their life, they don't say on their deathbed, gee, I wish I'd worked more. They want that part of their life. Have you gotten to that point yet?
I don't miss the 4-week-old yet. No, I don't. I have my hands full with a 3.5-year-old and 6-year-old.
Molly Barker emails us, I had the honor of being on a panel with Molly a few months ago. That one encounter made an indelible mark on my life. She's one of the most down-to-earth real people on the planet. Congrats on the book, You Go Girl, from Another Molly. And Tiffany on Facebook says, I feel everything Molly is saying. Working makes me a better person and a better mom.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Molly Grantham's book is called Small Victories, The Off-Camera Life of an On-Camera Mom. And I guess they can also follow you on Facebook and certainly on WBTV News. Molly, thank you for being here.
Appreciate it. Mike, thank you for having me.